So our next panel will be building on the presentation that we just had on examining the Canadian regulatory framework. We'll discuss some of the changes that we've seen in recent years and some of the challenges that have emerged. And then we'll get into a bit more detail specifically about the impact of the order protection rule and get some comments from the panel about where we go from here. So first, let me introduce the panel. To my left is Robert Young from Liquidnet Canada. Next to Robert is Deanna Jurjevic from TMX Group. Next to Deanna is Peter Haynes from TD Securities and Cindy Petlock, an independent consultant. So I wanted to note that we invite questions throughout the panel, and we'll also leave some time at the end for questions as well. Please feel free to put up your hand if you have a question, or there are question cards on the tables, and someone will come around and pick it up. So to start, it seems like the market has been in a continued state of change during recent years. And with these changes, challenges have emerged. And you heard from the previous presentation about some of the challenges that we've heard about from participants. But from your perspective, what do you see as the biggest challenges that have resulted? And Robert, maybe we'll just start with you.
Sure. I think I probably would maybe throw three out there. First, and it was touched on by the earlier panelists, complexity. The world is a much more complex place. There's complexity around the number of venues, of course, but just there's much more data, much more technology. Things are moving much more quickly, so there's much more complexity. Number two, and someone said consider where we were 10 years ago. You can no longer, you know, if you look at from Canadian regulation point of view, you can no longer kind of go, well, we'll just do kind of more or less what they did in the States. I think we've learned, and to our benefit, that we've had the courage to our benefit to go and figure out something better. We've learned that maybe just looking at the U.S. and bringing something from the U.S. north, which was maybe done in the past, doesn't work. So it's now the flip side of that is we're also able to participate globally much more and see regulation. We see regulation happen around the world and trickle around the world much more. But the complexity is choosing the right thing for Canada. And I think the third... The third big challenge is something, again, that was touched briefly, and I think we need to see more of it, and that is about investor confidence. I don't think there's a good index of this, or maybe there is an investor, a consumer confidence index. Maybe we need an investor confidence index, but I would suggest that, you know, looking around the room, there's a few people who have been in the industry for a long time. Whether it's 3 years or three decades, I'm not sure that investor confidence has been as challenged as it's been. And the big challenge for regulators is, you know, going back to, I guess what Howard was saying, putting together the people who provide capital and the people who require capital. They're both not confident in this market right now. And I think that's a big challenge for for regulators. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get into that in a little bit more detail about the challenge for regulators as we go on as well. But anyone to add to the challenges that have emerged?
I would definitely second the challenge around the complexity. I think we definitely ended up in a place where we didn't really plan to get so fast. I particularly think it's a short-term challenge. We probably need another 5 years to get over this. This was a phenomenal amount of change in a fairly short period of time, 5 to 10 years, for an industry that existed for 150 years and where everything was done in a similar way for so long. Going through so much change in a short time is very hard for all, you know, from technology systems, culture, skills, everything. So this is very difficult. And out of that comes confusion and comes fear, not the same on all levels. I actually believe our investors are pretty shielded so far. But most of us in this room and the participants are often confused. Confusion causes uncertainty, causes some sort of fear or not being sure that I'm doing the right thing, which causes some other behaviors that we should be very careful to watch for. The other thing that I would also say comes as a probably next step that comes out of complexity that I would love to see more of, and I know it's super hard, but I would like us to focus on that, is we're lacking an objective measure. So we spend endless time, like the previous panels talks a lot about all the things that we're looking at, the data that we're collecting, and various things that we worry about. But if you were to take, you know, 10 marketplaces in Canada and 15 in other markets and compare equities and fixed income, could you rank them? And could you say, well, this is now pretty good, let's move here and focus on this? Like, how do we actually look at good versus bad? Because we can be afraid to know, and like we can be drilling deeper and deeper, and then it's getting just more complex. So having something that helps us think about this and measure would be really good. And I think we just need to work through this whole complexity and getting used to it and developing the systems and the tools to deal with it, and we'll get better.
I spend a lot of time thinking about whether or not investor confidence is in fact affected by market structure. And there's been some studies done by the Kauffman Institute as well as David Weald, who have written about the IPO market in the U.S. being affected by market structure, and that the confidence of investors and companies to go public has been somehow affected or diluted by the structure of the market. And, you know, we went back to the flash crash, and how much of the flash crash was about investor confidence post the flash crash, or the media making it about investor confidence. So I think about that all the time. And even as recently as 6 months ago, we were talking about the IPO market in the U.S. being dead and that it was the structure of the market. Nobody's saying that now. So I think we got to recognize where we sit here in Canada. And again, I'm not by any means, and you'll hear in this panel, a fan of the way our market has evolved or where it's at today or where it may be going in the future. But I also want to be a little cautious about being too hyped up about cause and effect here. And I believe some of those folks that might have thought that it was the structure of the U.S. market that was holding back the U.S. IPOs, maybe the fact that it's up 25% this year and they were managed to get the Twitter open 2 weeks ago has more to do with the confidence in the U.S. market today. And we sit here in Canada up 8% on the year, 16% behind the U.S. and wonder if, you know, we're going to zero. When in fact, I think we have to recognize we're in a cycle here and our turn will come at some point. So I just, you know, on the question of investor confidence and the like, I have a mixed emotions on that topic.
So, I mean, much of what I was thinking of has been covered, but the way I really summarize it in my own mind was there's a big chicken and egg problem, right? Like, whenever we get into any of these issues, we keep circling around and saying, what's the cause? And it's because of the complexity, it's because of the interrelationship, it's because of the macroeconomic factors, all of these things, and it keeps coming back to how do you make a change that will not have the unintended consequences that were mentioned earlier, without getting more data so that you can understand, you know, which is the chicken and which is the egg.
And, I mean, so we've definitely heard of a lot of challenges that have come up, and one that that we hear about a lot is the number of new markets, so that the marketplace is growing and the complexity with that. And I guess what we've seen recently are some marketplaces emerge as a way to introduce either a new model or a new fee model. But I wanted to get your views on innovation, and can innovation continue without increased market fragmentation, without another market, and how, you know, how we look at innovation within the environment. So maybe we'll start over with
you. Go north. You know, it's interesting. This was actually my least favorite question of the ones we discussed, because to me, you can't really quantify innovation or say that there is any particular source of innovation or that there's any method that you can have it. There's no question that market participants are now at the point where they're saying, you know, just any new market is bad. Lots of people, enough already, right? Mm-hmm. That maybe we need to be focused on the ones we have, and maybe people need to be innovative within that. Clearly, when we had a monopoly, people were concerned that there wasn't enough innovation. So the question is, do you need another market? Well, of course you don't need another market to have innovation in the markets. But it depends on what innovations people are coming up with and whether they want to do it with people who are in existence or whether they want to do it themselves. So I think it's the focus on need. We don't need new markets for innovation, but maybe new markets will bring it.
With due respect for the gentleman from Omega who spoke earlier, to suggest that you're being innovative by not charging for data is absolutely ridiculous, quite honestly. I mean, this market has, what is innovation? Innovation is not a different fee structure. Innovation is what's being attempted now with Aquitas. Aquitas is truly being innovative in attempting to come up with a way to segment different types of orders in the market. And the regulator has a very difficult decision about whether or not they want to allow that innovation. I know we'll talk more about Aquitas, I'm sure, but if they do allow that innovation, then where do we go in terms of the slippery slope of additional marketplaces? I was in New York yesterday and met with a participant that has a pool of liquidity. And the gentleman was explaining to me how their structure works. And this is just from a segmentation perspective, not to relate to exactly what Aquitas is doing. But he's basically said, so we have our proprietary traders and we have HFTs that are in this pool. But if an institutional investor is willing to pay us 0.75 a share, we'll let them interact with our non-informed order flow first. And if they're only willing to pay us 50 cents or 0.5 cent or a 0.33 a share, then they'll have to be in the pool competing for that liquidity with HFTs and with our prop traders. That's the ultimate in segmentation. And that's what you have to worry about. Is this innovation, the type of innovation, and where do we end up on the slippery slope? So that's what I worry a little bit about as we evolve here and from an innovation perspective.
Any other comments, either Deanna or Robert?
Just like, for me, innovation is not an objective in itself. This is not a beauty contest. Like, it's not about, you know, we have another idea. This is what do we need to solve some problems. And I think, you know, again, looking back 7, 6 years, we've solved a bunch through competition. And, you know, even addressing fees, nothing really creative there, but that should be good for the market. So I think we can still see significant incremental benefits coming from the competition. Innovation is somewhat, it's an interesting thing. The tighter the conditions are between the regulatory environment, the harder it is to innovate. But sometimes you have to really think hard to come up with a way to improve the conditions. So innovations will happen, but that shouldn't be like the objective on its own. Like, we need to just keep looking on how we solve the problems that are plaguing the market.
Yeah, so, I would underscore that. I think we have to be, it was great, the earlier panel talking about going back to first principles. Mm-hmm. And I don't think innovation was a first principle. I'm kind of paraphrasing. I think a first principle is the efficiency of the market on behalf of companies that are trying to raise money and people, Canadians are trying to invest money. And you have a situation where if you have a monopoly, how do you make it an innovative monopoly? The solution or the current program we're following is to, you know, introduce competition. At some point in time, there's a diminishing return on that competition and there's a balancing act. This is yet another challenge for regulators to establish that balancing act between, you know, innovation nipping at the monopoly and making things efficient, but not, you know, not suffering all the negative consequences.
The word competition comes up a lot, Robert, and I think we think about competition and immediately think we need another marketplace. But that's the wrong form of competition. The form of competition we want is competing, having orders compete with each other for the top of the book, having participants compete, their willingness to be able to bid ahead of somebody else because they're willing to buy a stock. In a central limit order book, when we have 10 or 15 different fragmented marketplaces, it's hard to suggest that we're those individual orders that sit on each market are competing with each other.
Yeah, and they're not.
So I think that's a mistake that when we think about competition, it always ends up being about we need more marketplaces. I mean, I'm a proponent of a central limit order book with a utility structure overhead. Even though Howard doesn't want to be utility regulator, the reality is I think that's a structure that can work. But again, I know that brings us back to an environment a lot of people don't want to go to. Perhaps the genie's out of that bottle. But I do get frustrated when people talk about competition and immediately say it's about markets when it should be about orders.
One thing I just want to follow up on in terms of innovation is whether you see any barriers to innovation either within the current rule framework or whether it's just how the market has developed, but whether you see anything that's developed there.
I think that what I have seen over the past few years, and it kind of ties with Peter's point, is I don't think it's what he intended, but it's what I think about when I think about the activities of the participants, is that competition doesn't work if people aren't actually assessing fully what all the different offerings can give them and then doing everything they can to get the maximum benefit out of it, right? You have to have, you know, your buyers. If they're going to go to the store that has more expensive, you know, sweaters that are exactly the same as this one, potentially, or very similar, and really nasty sales stuff, but they keep going there because they've gone there for a decade, it doesn't change anything, right? So, and I'm not suggesting that that's exactly where we are, but for some people, not a lot of change happened when, in their practices, when the markets changed. So part of me says before a lot of changes are made, you have to really get a sense of what people are doing with the evidence of innovation that they're seeing. Are they fully exploring their options? And that includes all through, like the back office, this has been mentioned recently, all the way through all the costs, making sure that they're doing it. It's hard because everybody's busy and they don't want to be looking at all of these complex options. But before you can figure out whether innovations are working or whether competition's working, you have to look at whether people are actually changing any of their behaviors based on competition. And those are the barriers that I'd be really interested in. I don't know that they're regulatory so much as some of them are, but some of them are perception and practice barriers.
Any other comments on that?
My comment is I think the regulatory environment is pretty tight, so it is very hard to come up with different ideas, and we've seen that. That's why all these marketplaces look very similar. Whether that's wrong or not, I'm not sure. I mean, we debate these rules really carefully and try to come up with the best rule. And I'm not sure we should be opening up rules just so we can have more variety. I mean, again, there's something wrong with what we're doing. We need to open and look at that, but not just open it for the competition. But Cindy, my comment to you would be that to me speaks to the size of the problem. I think if a problem is big enough, people will know about the solutions and come to get them. So I think this may be showing that there's a small, you know, closed network of people that actually understands everything and is going for those benefits from the competition. And there's a large part of our ecosystem that's quite happy with what we have and worried about completely different problems that we're probably not focusing on.
So I wanted to move on a bit to the role of regulators and what you see as the role of regulators in the current environment. And Peter, maybe we'll start with you.
We'll stop.
I think that I'm happy that the Ontario Securities Commission and or CSA and IIROC are hosting conferences that are dedicated to market structure, because I think that the role of the regulator in the eyes of the general public historically has been about enforcement, putting the bad guys in jail. And for a long time, I think we've all felt like market structure and policy has been something that has been less of a focus for the regulators. And there's absolutely nobody in Canada or the U.S. or anywhere else who could claim that today. I think that the frustration, of course, we would all have would simply be with the pace at which regulators are able to make policy decisions, from concept releases to actual. To hear Jonathan and Tracy mention that we may get an OPR / access fee / data, another concept paper rather than a rule proposal potentially, which means another year before potentially we get some rules, that's frustrating to market participants who are watching the speed at which things are changing be at lightning pace. So I think that I'm very pleased to say the role of the regulator in terms of its focus on policy has been great. And I know it's the million-dollar question about the way in which we can make that process move any quicker.
No, and it's absolutely a balance in terms of consultation, and you want to get some early feedback to feed into that, but that's right, the time that goes into that definitely a factor that we consider. And just commenting on the consultation paper, definitely our intention to put something out. We're trying to see if we can put out something a little bit more than concepts in this and see if we can get a little further along, certainly because this is something that we've heard from people and, you know, want to put something out that we can...
I guess the other point, if I can add, and this is the difficult role of the regulator, is that you want to build consensus in how you actually make decisions, and you want to be informed by the marketplace. But with respect to, say, the data file that was done last year, to suggest that review was mixed was something you could have been able to predict in advance, because you have marketplaces that want to protect their monopoly, and you have... participants that want to find a way for data fees to be lowered. So clearly, we could have predicted in advance that there'd be a polar, or polar opposites with respect to what the views would be on that. So I think at some point, the role of the regulator is, I think, going to be to make a decision. And I know that's difficult, but on Aquatis, you're going to need to make a decision. On data fees, you're going to need to make a decision. And it's going to be very difficult for you ever to get consensus because of the commercial interests of the people that are responding to you. So I think that's going to pose a major challenge for regulators.
I would just like to I agree with that. I think the time delay is really tough because, you know, the world moves pretty quickly. Ideas move pretty quickly. Finding a way to shorten it. But for my part, I think the process here is superior to many other places. The process of, you know, going from kind of the generalities and collecting information and having conversations with people and working your way down. And, you know, I said it other times, the dark rule seemed to follow that process. I think that process is great. Any way we could find to speed up the process, mm-hmm. because as, again, was mentioned earlier here, the world changes. You know, it's almost like, you know, you introduce a rule that you've thought about for 3 years, and it was a real problem 3 years or 4 years ago. By the time you get introduced, the world's moved on. Mm-hmm. So for commercial reasons and for just practical reasons of rulemaking, we need to find a way to make it much more tight. But if I look at France or the U.S., where things are heavily politicized, we're fortunate not to have that here. So I think our rulemaking process is much superior in terms of the process we follow.
I think that's an excellent point that Robert's making about the comparison to other marketplaces, in particular the United States. I might not like the dark pool rule that was put in place here in Canada, but it is an example where a regulator made a decision. They had consultations with the street and participants, and they made a decision. So I don't like it. If the regulator in the United States has and continues to attempt to try and put the same rule in place, whether you call it a trade out rule, whether you want to get rid of internalization, payment for order flow, they can't achieve that goal. Why? Because there's 30,000 paid lobbyists in Washington that are dealing with all the Congress people that are responsible for ultimately having the oversight committee on the SEC that's going to make that decision. And whether they want to get rid of payment for order flow, they have all the wholesalers and the retail brokers that are in their with their lobbyists. If they want to get rid of the trade out rule, they have all the dark pool, all the brokerage firms, and other marketplaces in their lobbying, and they can't get it done politically. And we have an incredible advantage here in Canada that we don't have the political interference with respect to our regulators being able to make decisions, at least in any way, to the same level as the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. We've sort of jumped to the how do they fix it, but I mean, part of the role, I think that we'd all agree with, is they got to set the framework, right? And the problem is setting the framework takes a long time because it's like the plumbing of everything. And as we've seen in, you know, in other countries, including the U.S., and we were talking about, remember what happened with short selling, right? The politician said you got to do it. Those were some of the fastest rules that ever went in place and some of the worst founded, right? They were huge mistakes and the consequences are still following. So we want our regulators to take a measured response to things. We want our regulators to look at the framework. And I think one of the things, and I can't really tell because this stuff you don't necessarily see for if you're outside of a particular organization. But what I sense isn't happening as much as maybe we need to before a lot of change happens is that not just conversations with participants by regulators, but actually regulators seeing what participants are doing. And that includes markets and market participants, right? And I know you do, you know, reviews of marketplaces. I haven't heard, and maybe someone in the room can say, whether there have been any meaningful best ex reviews by IIROC yet that's been in the works for ages. And before you say, let's rely on best execution, why don't we understand what best execution looks like today so that you can have an informed decision if you're going to make any changes that are going to go to that. And I just want to say, because I am a market structured geek, that everybody keeps talking about OPR and we go back, revert to there being no, you know, price protection. We have never really not had price protection in Canada. It just didn't matter in the years when there weren't multiple markets, but there was a universal market integrity rule that basically put the same obligation just on dealers, not on buy side, but same obligation. So if we remove OPR, that will be the first time in decades that there's not an order protection rule of some sort in place. And, you know, I think it's important to remember the history so that when we go forward, we're doing it, you know, fully aware of what it is and not sort of like a soundbite, oh, get rid of it and let's march on. So
no, and I definitely
not saying I'm
get,
against it, I'm just saying that's one of the
no,
things.
No, and I want to get to more into detail on the order protection rule, but I see that there's a question from the audience or said there was a question over there. Dan? Oh, sorry, there's one before you, Dan. Andy, if you can just say your name.
Hi, I'm Andy O'Hara from TradeBot, and this is going back a little bit, I apologize, but I want to talk about real quickly something that Peter said, and he said competition should happen amongst orders, not amongst markets. And I would say that I think competition among markets is necessary, or else how do you know that the utility, Peter, that you want run, how do you know that's efficiently meeting the use or serving the needs of its users? I mean, if I remember correctly, I think TD was an investor in Alpha, and that certainly goes against that idea of having one club that you ask for. And then second of all, I would say that competition for orders on an order-by-order basis happens best with segmented order flow, which certainly goes against a club. So, you know, I just don't know how those fit together.
Don't let him have a microphone. And we need, Andy, unfortunately, we're going to need a different panel to have that debate because I probably shouldn't have even said that was my view early on because I figured somebody was going to attack me and say I'm anti-competitive in some way. And I understand exactly what Andy's saying, and that is that if you only have one marketplace, and even if it is a utility that's run for profit, that the incentives just aren't there anymore to innovate. Innovate in the form of new order types, innovate in the form of ensuring that the structure remains best practices such that we know that the orders that are in the central limit order book are competing with each other in a fashion that is best for the various types of investors. And absolutely, Andy, we can have that debate. I don't necessarily believe we need And I know, let's actually just make sure we understand it's Andy O'Hara from TradeBot in Kansas City. Kansas City's in the United States. In the United States, there's complete paranoia over a monopoly of marketplaces. That's existed for years. Whereas in Canada, we didn't have that same paranoia. We had one TSX. They've had the NASDAQ and the NYSE and BATS and others for a long time. So, I think that you're right to say that it's going back in a different direction to suggest we have one individual marketplace. But at the same time, where we're at today and where we're appearing to be going is in the opposite direction. It is not to have less marketplaces. And frankly, if we want to get to true competition of orders and keep it at different marketplaces, and I know you're going to poke 25 holes in this, you could eliminate the issue around priority across different markets and go to a straight time priority across marketplaces, which I know introduces all kinds of clock management, atomic clock management, and gaming that goes on there. But at the same time, I think that these are thoughts that I think we should not dismiss, because I don't think any of us appreciated the unintended consequences that happened as a result of the move to multiple marketplaces and where we are today. So I think we therefore need to consider all the options.
Can I add? I find it interesting. Everybody who sits up here is always extreme, right? Last time Peter has said this before, that shouldn't surprise anybody, knows him, he wants the monopoly. My response last time was, we were all around for it and nobody liked it, right? Like it had technology issues. There were problems. And those were fixed. I would argue those were fixed by competition. It was the impetus that got the money spent on figuring that out. On the other hand, is competition, is it valuable to have, once TSX was, to have an exact same replica doing the same things? I would argue that we would be worse off if we had a monopoly. If we didn't, everybody would then go back to saying, how do you do blocks, right? The Liquidnets of the world bring in a different model that serves a different purpose. And to me, that is unquestionably beneficial competition, right? How much you need others along the way to enforce that competitive spend and make people better is the question, right? Maybe it does go too far. I don't know what regulators can do about that. I don't know how they say, okay, we're cutting it off here. We have enough. But to go back to a monopoly, it was a regulated monopoly. It didn't fix those problems when it was a regulated monopoly the last time.
So we had another question from Dan.
Yeah.
Thank you. Dan Kisus from Chikes, Canada. One part of my question was answered by the question that Andy asked, but the question was around, the second part was around still the central limit of the book, and I'm just wondering the view of warning or thinking that a central limit of a book would be better for the markets. Is it a view based on cost and complexity only, or is it a view based on liquidity, accessing liquidity and market quality? If it's cost, I think we can understand the view and it's being dealt with the OPR review. If it's one of market quality and complex and accessing the liquidity, then is where technology is today in terms of having an NBBO, in terms of having more and more sophisticated routers linking all these marketplaces into maybe a quasi-central limit order book. Is this not maybe a solution or a viable alternative?
I guess it's me again.
Question for you, Peter.
Say over to you, Peter.
I shouldn't have accepted this opportunity to speak in front of this audience. I know. Dan, it's a great question, okay? And to Cindy's point, can we have kind of competition? And I think the regulators are looking at the kind of competition environment today with their review of OPR. Clearly, they've recognized that based on what you've heard and what we've all read, that the proliferation of marketplaces and the captive consumer environment that we're in, as it's referred to, is one that does potentially have some costs that can be dealt with in some form of regulatory action, potentially, and we'll obviously have to wait to see how that plays out. The complexity, the cost, the multiple marketplaces, the implicit costs that the structure of the market today introduces, the the costs that are, quite frankly, starting to be better discussed amongst the community from an academic as well as, like, most people believe that all the academics out there are in favor of today's market structure, HFTs, lower spreads, narrow trading costs. The reality is there's a new sort of group of researchers that are coming out looking at the institutional impact of the current market we're in. There was a study done by a professor from Iowa comparing the costs from certain market participants looking at Abel Noser research against the actual trading costs on NASDAQ, and the conclusion is that the HFTs are active in the liquid stocks. The more a one standard deviation increase in HFT activity increased the trading costs of the institutional investor by 10%. So there seems to be a positive correlation between institutional costs and HFT activity. So this is where we're going, Dan, now, I think, and it's positive and it's healthy that we're looking at it this way. And it's absolutely true to say that going to a club, going back to where we were, although it by no means would be exactly the same because it would be in a different structure than a mutual. And again, it's all hypothetical. I know that. And it's my personal view. By no means is it a view of anyone else in the organization I work with. It might be, but at any rate, it's you know, there's obviously a lot of questions. It's a good question, Dan. I don't have all the answers, but I'm happy to say that I think that some of the right research is now being done.
So I'm sure others have comments on that as well. So,
just on the monopoly, you know, I was very much in favor of a monopoly when I was at the TSX.
I worked at the TSX.
That's right,
Peter and I both worked there. Yeah, come to there. You know, frankly, I don't think there are very many admired monopolies. Are not admired by anybody other than the employees, perhaps, and certainly the stockholders. They're not the sort of entities that move societies forward. So my comment on that. I think that a couple of things that have come up here, though, about the central limit order book are about orders competing with each other. And there's a new, you know, and I read the Abel Noser study, and by the way, I think the takeaway on HFT, you know, there's that term, is that you're absolutely right, Peter, the maturity of scientific and academic research around high-frequency computer-generated trading has really changed in the last 18 to 24 months. So if you're looking at stuff and it's got like a 2009 or 2007 handle on, you might want to kind of rethink about that. But what is evolving is a consequence of technology is allowing the guy I trade with to identify me, to read my footprints in a way that he couldn't very efficiently before. And that's drawing people to say, well, if I'm acting as an agent, I have an agent obligation to make sure that I'm going to the marketplace or interacting with the sort of order that is going to not be detrimental to my client. So now we're starting to say, well, you know, see people saying segmenting the books, as you said the conversation yesterday in New York, or, you know, I want to be able to interact with certain types of liquidity. People are identifying different types of liquidity. That makes a challenge for a central limit order book, but it is truly an innovation. I think you said, you know, not just, you know, just another, you know, another Chevy Impala with a different logo on it and a different price. We're seeing that. And I think that's going to be a challenge for regulators to get their heads around this notion that investors want to choose the type of liquidity they interact with.
I just want to say I work for TMX and I'm for competition, so maybe something has changed. And I just want to comment on the basic sense of competition that we initially talked about. So we can never forget what we have south of the border. So we are competing with the U.S. We're not competing in here. So if we bury our competitive hats and we go back to being very complacent, we will lose the battle before we know it. So I love competition. Keeps us all on the toes and keeps us reminding us what matters, forces us all to learn and keeps our clients really choosy and opinionated and makes us all much better. So I'm all for variety. But I think as the market is evolving, and we heard a lot of those issues earlier today, it really keeps pointing to that need for segmentation. In order to solve some of the problems, one size really doesn't fit all. So there's more and more need to allow certain interactions under certain barriers, which, of course, contradicts their access and central limit books and brings all kinds of other issues. But that's the pull that we're seeing for sure now.
It doesn't contradict, you know, equities market is kind of the only market in the world where, you know, wholesale and retail all get jammed into one store. It's irrational. I want to buy 1,000 T-shirts. I've got to buy them one at a time down at at Sears.
To be even more specific, Robert, Canada is one of the few markets where that actually happens. Because if you go south of the border, wholesale and retail do not interact with each other very often. Or they, if they do, they do so with an intermediary somehow getting in the middle of it. The direct linkage between retail and wholesale in Canada is closer than it is certainly south of the border or in any other asset class. So we do deserve some credit for the way that the Canadian market has been structured in comparison to, say, the way the market has evolved south of the border.
Well, I'm not just talking about stock market or equity markets or financial markets. I'm just generally speaking, you know, cramming every buyer and seller, no matter whether he's buying one or 1,000, is not a common way that markets are structured. You know, there's a whole summer. We have a food terminal down here, the Ontario Food Terminal, for people who are out of town. You know, down here, and that's if you want to buy a truckload of potatoes, that's where you go. If you want to buy a bag of potatoes, you go somewhere else. This is this is where segmentation is going. So I want to buy a truckload, not a bag.
The only problem with that argument, though, Robert, is and when we look internationally, and this maybe it's changed. I haven't looked for a little bit, but you don't have retail participation in a lot of markets around the world. It's just inaccessible, right? And you don't have retail participation. One of the reasons we don't talk about the debt markets, the derivatives markets, as the question was earlier, is because, you know, regulators are pretty busy trying to figure out how to protect retail, that the one group that they know they need to pay more attention to. Obviously, others are important too, but that's where you start. You don't have them. Europe, people invest in collective investment schemes. They don't go directly to markets. So it's tough to make the analogy, because one of the reasons we have the markets we have is because they are, you know, any order is treated the same. So maybe, like before, we just assume that it's good because sophisticated investors want to be able to choose who they invest with to maximize their value. You've got to look at the other side and say, are we going to lose something in sort of the agnostic nature of our markets that everybody feels confident they are being treated the same? Before, you know, just sort of saying, yeah, no, segmentation's good because we know people are struggling and they want this solution. So I do think that we have to remember that little piece of it because it gets lost on almost every occasion.
I just want to add, I mean, segmentation, I don't know that we know where it's good. We just see a lot of ask for it. But I want to say, it's definitely different for Canada than other jurisdictions. We're too small. Any additional segmentation is, like, we're on borderline of actually existing as a separate, like, little eco-center. So if we have to be super careful, anything that we do that it's not kind of further breaking it up and really killing that price discovery process, which I agree with you. I think we have a very high, healthy retail participation in Canada compared to other markets because it was like that all along. What would it mean if it wasn't? You know, we would need time to see that for sure.
So I want to change gears a bit and get into order protection, but see if there's questions first. So.
On the idea of wholesale, I want to be ridiculous a little bit for a second, on wholesale and retail interacting that way. If we're concerned, as we were mentioning earlier, about people's confidence in the market, in general people's view of the market, which I think has very little to do with market structure and much more to do with people being taken away in handcuffs on television. But if we create a system where you can pay up or where wholesale is treated completely differently, well, that will be proof to the general public that the game is rigged. That just the idea that there is a black book where I can pay up so that I can interact with the uninformed order flow is really telling me that you can pick off retail trades for a price, you know, as you mentioned earlier. And I remember when it was a member firm 100%, a member firm monopoly, and it was very enjoyable to be at a member firm. You know, there were no direct market access. Anybody who wanted to trade in Canada had to come through one of us, and we charged you. And, you know, that system's just gone. You know, so it's, but the idea that you can pay a different price to interact with different, I mean, at least our system before, now time is less, there is no time priority. Acted as if one person buying 100 shares at one price was equal to anybody else. And any move away from that, I think, especially like a wholesale market versus a retail market, would just crush any faith in the system.
Does anyone have a comment?
What I would say is that my example that I gave earlier was simply just the structure of the U.S. market as it is today. It's not one participant or one dark pool that behaves in that fashion. This is segmentation right down to the individual clients. You can actually, in some cases in the U.S., you can go to the dark pool operator that you're active in and say, here's the last 100 fills that I got from your dark pool. and 40 of them are one participant, or these 40 orders right here were all adverse selection orders where the market moved away from me when I interacted with that particular order, I never want to trade against that particular client ID again, and the dark pool will allow that. So that's the extreme customer segmentation, wholesale, retail. Retail is the lowest member of the food chain versus the institution willing to pay the largest amount. I don't think that's a healthy structure to get to by any means. I've been with a member firm for 18 years. I was with the TSC before that. I don't think that we can compare, though, the era of the member firm, the co-op that existed, the mutual that existed in 2002 prior to that, to today, because the last 10 years have been a period where we've seen changes that nobody could have predicted in terms of access to the market and electronic access. So it is a little bit different to compare that era to today. But at the same time, I hear exactly what you're saying, that if we, I worry about where we may evolve to, and our regulators, I sense, have that same fear with respect to where we evolve and whether we end up in a structure that's close to the U.S. market where there's, it's at the extreme in terms of segmentation.
Okay, I see we have one question over there. Evan?
I guess just 2 points to make. Evan Young from Scotia. You know, I think segmentation, I think, is something that needs to be looked at. I think we have a problem right now where the average retail order is paying to interact with somebody who, you know, has been identified as willing to pay to interact with it. Like, the economics are not just off, they're completely backwards in a lot of cases right now. And that's, you know, starting to evolve with different pricing from different markets. But I think to the point of investor fears, I think a lot of it has to do with semantics. And, you know, I object to the term, you know, uninformed retail flow. I think that has a lot to do with, you know, calling our retail investors uninformed, and more to do with the fact that there's a lot of them and that they're more random than 100,000 share institutional order. So, you know, if I interact with a retail order, the odds of the next one being in the opposite direction are higher than if I interact with an institutional order that may have, you know, 95,000 shares behind it. And I think, you know, we need to be really careful about how we talk about, you know, certain activities and certain participants. And you know, it does color it. I think that, you know, a lot of these debates, when they end up on the front page of the, you know, the public, you know, mass distribution newspapers, end up in really dangerous kind of semantics. And I think that you know, we have to be careful about how we characterize that and why people want to do it. And you know, the idea that the retail flow is, you know, it's not so much it's more valuable, but it's less dangerous than, say, trying to buy the, you know, first 100 shares of a 100,000 share order. And you know, they're just very different flows. And you get, you know, the complexity goes up when you start talking segmentation, but it's not in and of itself a bad thing. You know, the U.S. has probably taken it a little further than it should, but, you know, I think it's certainly something that's worth evaluating. So.
Okay. Any comments before we move on? Okay. Is there anything else from the audience? Okay. So what I wanted to get a little bit further into is the order protection rule and the discussion just before this about what we're looking at and issues associated with the framework. So just wanted to get your perspectives. You heard Jonathan and Tracy talking about the objectives underlying the order protection rule. Just wanted to get your views on order protection as a principle and whether you think it's one that's worth upholding or has it really outlived its purpose at this point. So anyone...
Well, so I actually kind of laughed because I was remembering a recent proposal that brought out values and said, you know, so I'll just say the same thing. You know, anybody in here, you know, against fairness in the markets? I'm pretty sure nobody's against fairness in the markets, right? Is anybody against, you know, good price discovery? Right, and that's the problem. I mean, the question really is, and why the answer to are the principles behind OPR usually supported is they're pretty motherhoody, right? Like, yes, we want fair markets, and yes, we want good price discovery. So I think the real question is it achieving those goals? Is it having consequences that are interfering with something else like efficiency in a different way that require a change?
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on the principles behind OPR and...
My colleague spoke earlier, asked a question, and Dave Panko earlier about whether or not access fees were going to be part of the discussion around OPR, and I'm glad to hear that the answer was yes, that they would be to some degree. And I think Evan made the point earlier that there's prices in the market, but there's rebates. Some people are paying for flow, others are paying, firms are paying the fees for their clients. Some are passing them through. So there's somewhat of an inequality with respect to the prices that we see in the market, the rebates, the new marketplaces that we have that are actually inverted fee structures, the difference in economics between being routed to one market and another, introducing additional issues around agency issues for brokerage firms to address as well. I think those are issues that maybe weren't considered necessarily around the principle of the rule, which I think we all agree, and Cindy made the point of being fair, is that every order that's posted in a market that we can see that's at the best price deserves to be filled first. Well, we don't have that now because we have don't have time priority across markets, so that's issue number one. And we also have different fee structures in different markets and agency issues. So the original intent was absolutely the right thing. I think how things have evolved isn't necessarily exactly how the regulators might have wanted it, which quite rightly is why I think it's being reviewed at this point in time.
Yeah, I think I would say I think it's right to review it. And I Peter brought up a really interesting point. I think it may be misstated, though. He said, and I'm in violent agreement with you, that you know, we have a problem with timing across the market, but timing doesn't really come into price, but it does come into fairness. And the perception, I think, generally in the world is if you show up first, you're first. So we don't have time protection across the markets, but we do have price protection. And we spend a lot of time on price protection with unintended consequences. That's not the right term, but you know what I mean? Coming out of the OPR rule, we haven't really kind of, in re-examining it, again, back to first principles and say, what are we trying to do here? I'm trying to build investor confidence that we have a fair market. And that, you know, let's assume, maybe not assume, that price is seen as the guy who pays most should go first. But the guy who gets there first, he thinks he should go first. So we have a broader set of, it's a very tangly web, a broader set of things.
You're introducing it's a very complex topic. And yeah. I know I hate to say that because, but that seems to be a general theme that we're talking about complexities. Time is equated to speed. Speed is perceived to be a competitive advantage for marketplaces. If I have a marketplace with the fastest matching engine, that's a better marketplace to execute on.
Innovation.
That's considered part of the so-called innovation and competitive aspects of the market. And I think to your point, it shouldn't necessarily be the case. But being able to regulate speed, regulate time, introduces in itself additional unintended consequences. There's no necessarily easy solution. There's lots of suggestions. There's more academic work being done on that. But at some point, I think if we're going to solve those issues, it's going to require someone making very bold decisions, because there'll be different perspectives on whether that truly is part of competition. And if we go to a market where we go to time priority across marketplaces, we've essentially created a virtual club, central limit order book, and we're moving in the direction that I had said earlier I would be in favor of. And it will also make us all wonder a little bit more about, you know, why we have all these other competing marketplaces that have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% market share.
And just to make it entertaining, so, you know, price time is, and might not, you know, maybe we want to think about whether or not that's what's going to drive the perception and the reality of fairness. Maybe it isn't, but if it is, then we have to look at the fact that a lot of orders in this market are not price time, they're price broker time. So, you know, it just starts to get very, very, very complex. Good luck to you.
I was going to say, I think you got your answer, because not only are we okay with OPR, we now want to put, like, time priority, so, like, we want to really box this in. So a couple comments to all these topics. So I'm a big supporter of principles, for sure. I mean, as Sandy said, there's not much to debate there. Like, we know what we're trying to do. OPR is a tool to get those principles protected, and the question now is this the right tool? Any tool has its negative side effects, no question. I think it's an initial objective has been met. I think we have saved the end investor from understanding what is going on, which I think is our duty. Like, people deciding what they buy for retirement shouldn't even be aware of multiple markets. They really don't need to know any of this stuff. Now, how do we keep their confidence? That's a whole issue. So for me, having this virtual consolidated book is very important. And I would hate to see the liquidity kind of go back to fragmented pools, with Best X being the only guidance. I don't think that's good enough for Canada. Now, is 100% compliance necessary? Probably not. And I think a lot of this unintended consequences is not it's really talking about the fringes. So we have, you know, we took the rule to tool too far. We have to find ways to soften the edges. And I think that's what you guys are looking at. I'm not saying it's easy, because every time the grass is always greener on the other side. So as soon as you propose something, we'll all be over to tell you why that's not going to work. And so that's going to be an interesting process. But, I mean, we understand what's wrong with what we have right now or perceive wrong or whatever, so that's easy to talk about. But we have to be very careful when we choose to soften it up where we go. But I would keep OPR there for sure. Now, I want to go comment something else. You guys went into time priority, and then you actually went into speed of changing engines and everything else. It's getting to time priority means you're getting away from fee priority. So we actually don't have price broker time. We have price broker fee time. That's how our markets work today. And that's a very interesting, and I don't have a view on that, but like we did this whole multiple markets to deal with the fees. So if we're not going to say, well, there's no fees, it's only time, then the whole competition on pricing is not going to be possible. So that's an interesting, again, let's recommend something and we can then debate on how that would look, but I don't think these are easy questions to solve.
So it seems on the principles, there seems to be agreement on it. What do you think would be the biggest impact on the market if our review resulted in some loosening of OPR? And I think you heard before, really, at this point, everything's on the table in terms of making some tweaks, looking at it broader. But what do you see as the biggest impact?
Here's the complication, Susan, on this, and you've heard this from me before, but I'll repeat for the broader audience. Let's just suggest, for instance, that hypothetically the review says that we do not need to connect to marketplaces that have a market share below X percent or have a somehow defined contribution to price discovery below a certain threshold. So that might initially be seen as a positive in dealing with a captive consumer problem. And maybe it's something that's not grandfathered, and next thing you know, a few marketplaces that exist today don't exist unless they demonstrate those characteristics. Put yourself in the shoes of a brokerage firm, though, that deals with institutional clients. You're now essentially forcing us to make a decision. Are we going to take the responsibility of executing orders for our clients, investors, bypassing those marketplaces where there may be better price limit orders on those markets that we've decided not to connect to? And are we willing to take the risk that we could be, it could be argued we're not achieving best execution for our client because we chose not to connect to those marketplaces? So that's the difficulty. I can tell you that most firms are going to meet with their best execution committees and conclude that even though the rule changed, we still have to connect to these markets. So it hasn't solved the problem necessarily. And so I don't know. I'm just kind of trying to think through where do we go under that scenario. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that we may remain in an environment that the folks that are critical of the structure today, a partial rule change doesn't solve their problems.
And I think you have to add on top of that the fact that if you set hard limits, as we've seen, it's not like trading just sort of happens and then the numbers rack up. You can actually achieve outcomes. We've seen it already. You can move flow. It's easy, right? People get together. They have discussions. They write memos, and then flow moves. So to set a limit, it would be pretty easy for some of our larger participants to actually just achieve an outcome if they wanted to get flow onto a market to get it to a certain point or take flow off a market to get it below so that it would not be caught. So I just think that it's just too arbitrary. Like whatever level you set, it would be so easy for it to just be sort of an end goal by participants to get what they want out of those. So it has to be through something else. There has to be another way of relieving the pressure that does not sort of create incentives. I mean, we've already looked at it, right? Ownership, right? That issue is out there. Trading firms own places. You can't just set limits, or else you've got incentives that are all out of whack.
Okay, Robert, I think you had a comment. Or?
I think you had a question.
Okay, yeah, Fanula has a question.
Hi, it's Fanula Martin. The research that's been done recently, which I think is wonderful, do you know if they're doing any simulations? I mean, given the cheapness of technology and data, to take the scenarios that we're talking about, seeing what would be the impact if we put this kind of flow through a simulator, changing the rules to see whether or not the outcomes are what is expected. Do you know if anybody's doing that kind of research?
I don't personally know if anyone's doing that research, and I'm not sure I'd lend a lot of credence to that type of simulation because of the ability to be able to control for all the variables that exist in the market.
I think the objective is to ensures high confidence by the investors. I mean, the idea of the order protection rules, you know, by the name, is you're protecting a guy's order. So if you don't have a way of measuring how this retail investor feels about the marketplace, I'm not sure I get how it works.
Question though was whether or not there is research being done about the various rule changes that might exist, the various structural discussions, whether or not there's ways to simulate the market and determine what outcomes might have been under a different set of rules. And I believe that is a very, very complex task that would be open to interpretation.
Yeah, Howard touched on that. You see, he talked about, with technology, you've got to manage its hostilities. And when I think when you do rule change, you've got to manage ambitions. And you really don't know what those ambitions are going to be in a controlled environment.
And so the CEO of the New York Stock Exchange was testifying in Congress on the Jobs Act, and you're probably familiar with the fact that the U.S. wants to start a pilot study to widen spreads for small-cap stocks because the belief will be that wider spreads will allow firms to profit more from trading, and they will then reinvest those proceeds into research coverage of smaller companies, leading to more IPOs, et cetera. Well, I think we found out we don't necessarily need that aspect of the Jobs Act to reignite the IPO market. But his comment on that was, sure, we're happy to start a pilot study, but I can guarantee at the end of the day, one group will say this is what happened, and another group will say that's what happened. And the results will be subject to interpretation. And that's what you worry about in any of these. And that's why I believe, I know that we always hear we want data-driven analysis. And I do agree that data-driven analysis is important. But there has to be someone at the end of the day that interprets that data with a human element and is willing to make bold decisions one way or another.
Okay, I think we had a few other questions. Is there one over there? Is that, yeah.
Hi, Peter Clausi. First a question and then a comment. Of everybody here, how many are with actual issuers whose shares trade on the exchange? All right. We've been building public companies for 20 years. We're not data, we're securities. And I guess the point I'd like to make to you is don't forget that at the end of the day, your data is driven from us. And what you do is driven by the companies we build and the money that we raise. As an entrepreneur, I find a lot of this black box voodoo to be a problem for us. I'd love to get rid of Broadridge. They know more about my company than I do, and they won't even sell us the data. So when you're sitting and trying to plan for the future, don't forget that it's guys like me and a couple of the other people in the room who pay for everybody in this room. We raise the money. It's our trading fees and our listing fees that create all of this. So when you're trying to set policy, don't forget that there are actual reporting issuers underneath you trying to carry on business.
Yeah. Oh, here. Thank you for your comment, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think we had one other question over there, I was told. No?
Do we?
Okay. So I know we don't have much time left, so there's probably just enough time for one more question. I do want to get your perspectives on what you believe is the one issue or risk area that regulators should be focused on in the next little while. And anyone?
Unfortunately, I don't think there's any low-hanging fruit or one area. I don't see that. Our rules are very intertwined. Everything sticks together as a structure, so if you try to pull one thing out, a lot of stuff will crumble. So I don't see it ever as one individual thing that we can focus on. But maybe there can be a slight shift in how we look at coming up with some rules or frameworks and so on. So we talked a lot about data-driven rulemaking process, and I think that's a nice complement to what we do. I think it can only make us better, so that I think we're already there. That's great. I would like to see us all start thinking more about moving away from the one-size-fits-all model. Like, we have that across everything. We apply the same trading rules for symbols that trade on venture once a month to ETFs that trade like crazy on our markets, to things that are interlisted with U.S. and things that are only listed here. And we just apply the same rules, and we try to apply statistical theoretical approach to those numbers. Again, our market is not big enough to warrant that blanket statistical numbers-driven conclusions. We will have to start breaking up the pie a little bit further and try to drill in. So, you know, whatever, we have a bunch of rules specifically in IROC that have specific numbers attached to them, like a threshold this way, that way. We need to move away and have probably bigger segmentation. That's going to sound like more complexity initially, but if we want to get more efficiency from the market, we will have to do that. Otherwise, we're caught in dialogues where one person is talking about his experience in ETF and the other guy is talking about his experience in venture. They're never meeting, like the conversation is going nowhere. So we'll have to do that. And then the ultimate solution would be once we recognize the need for different models, is to have somehow to try and come up with models where the numbers and the limits and the thresholds and everything else is market-driven as opposed to set by marketplaces, set by regulators, because those are always bound to be wrong. I mean, you know, circuit breakers are good. You want to make sure you have no worse than. But get the market to do what markets do best and pick the right and best fee and rule and approach and everything else as much as we can without impacting our co-op. So that would be a tall order, but that's what I would like to see.
I'll follow up on the gentleman who spoke earlier, who was an issuer, and suggest that he's absolutely correct at the end of the day that we don't have a market in Canada without issuers. And on the topic of data, data is arguably the investor that first puts the order into the market or gives us an order. It's their data. Then we send the order to the exchange, and the exchange takes the data, and then they turn around and they charge us for that data, which originated with our customer order. So that is a sort of circuitous loop that we deal with. And on the same vein, I had a vendor tell, or an issuer tell me that a vendor came in to their office and wanted to sell them updated shareholder information. No, no, no. We get shareholder information every quarter and the 13F filings and from the other vendors and the information that's public. No, no, no. We'll give you more up-to-date information. Well, where are you getting that information? We're speaking to brokers. What? You're going to tell me that brokers are actually telling you information about who's trading your stock and then you're turning around and trying to sell that to an issuer? I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous, but that is a reality. So what my roundabout answer to your question, Susan, is that we have to remember what, at the end of the day, what we do is about protecting the Canadian market and making sure that we remain top of mind globally with respect to what our strengths are, and that anything that that risks the ability of the Canadian market to be top of mind when it comes to mining and energy globally and for our other niches that we're so good at, anything that takes away from that is something that we need to look very negatively on. And so I think that's where I come back to. It is the issuer. It is the investor. We've got to remember that.
You know, and this is challenging because it seems like, you know, we could have a different panel on a different thing, and we'd be saying we should, the regulators should be focused on this because there's so many different things going on, and there's no question that we're not really looking at the markets as we have them from junior all the way through. We know that there are investors out there who want to invest in companies. We know people want to start new things up. That's why crowdfunding has become an issue that everybody has heard about, right? There's an interest in just getting in at the ground level. People are sort of excited about that kind of thing. What's the regulatory response? So I think regulators have to be looking at that for one thing, because even if you don't like crowdfunding, you have to understand why it's fulfilling a need and then deal with it. But I do go back to what I was talking about before. I think it's been so many years now since there was a best execution review where everybody sort of stopped and said, what actually is it? How are people fulfilling it, right? These questions were asked years ago. Now there's all these tools that never existed. And when we talk about data, it's not necessarily just crunching the numbers. It's also in just gathering information so it's more tangible when everybody's talking about it. Because I guarantee you, if we started talking about best execution, you would hear numerous different opinions about whether it's met in what circumstance, because it actually is an ongoing thing that evolves, right? So to me, all of these things keep coming back to whether or not there's an underpinning of best ex that's, you know, that's working so that all these other things can work on top of them. And I think that it's kind of getting lost a little bit in some of the discussions, because you could get rid of OPR tomorrow, as Peter said. It could be that everybody just says, well, best execution is going to make me want to do very similar things as OPR. So where have we gotten to? That, I think that conversation has to be had before other things are decided.
Robert?
So I think those are great ideas. Once you get those three done, because I think they're really great ideas, you get those three done, then you can spend some time on mine. So my idea is kind of like, is about Android, the operating system for phones, which has like an 86% market share. It's extremely successful. This is very open. And we're in a unique situation in Canada where we've got highly measurable marketplace, and I think you really want to give some thought. My suggestion is give some thought to sharing some of these markers, institute some more markers. Markers are not too tough. I mean, brokers collect a lot of markers that they don't distribute. What if that information was more broadly available? Because, you know, there's a lot of great people out there building Android apps who might actually be able to help us with some of these observations and build some environments to test this stuff out. If you put the information out there, you get a lot of good feedback on how to improve the market. So nobody in the world is able to do that. No other market, I think, has the infrastructure to do that. It's a unique competitive advantage for Canada. So after you get these three done, think about that.
We're going to have to wrap up. Is there anything, people have one last question?
Oh, and a national regulator.
And a national regulator. Yeah, right. Next, we'll leave that. Okay.
After the four or before your four?
We'll put that first. So thank you, everyone. It's been a great discussion, and it's almost noon, so we're going to have to conclude our panel now. I just really want to thank our panelists for their contributions, Cindy, Peter, Deanna, and Robert, and lunch will be served in a few minutes. So please enjoy. We're going to be starting back at 1:15 with a presentation by Victoria Pennington on HFT research. So thank you.